Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. As Congress looks to repeal the Affordable Care Act, a bill moving forward in the state legislature aims to provide free health care for all Californians, and we'll have details on just what's covered on today's show. Then on Green Scene, we'll have some disturbing news about ocean levels off our coast that are rising even faster than climate scientists predicted. Plus, learn what's been causing bees to lose their ability to fly. We'll have an update on Border Angels activist Hugo Castro, who was kidnapped and beaten while helping migrants in Mexico. Then from CAL FIRE, hear about a brand new app to help you get ready for wildfires. And then hear about hikers rescued off local trails, and we'll have some safety tips to remember whenever you go hiking. Next up, learn about proposals to improve traffic safety on Highway 67. Our newsmaker interview today is with Mark Hansen and Terry Steele from Heartland Youth Build, which just got a federal grant of over $1 million to help provide an education and jobs for young people, as well as build affordable homes in our region. They're also hosting a Cool Car Classic coming up on May 13th at their charter school in City Heights. From Public News Service, hear why national monuments in California, including giant sequoia redwoods, are threatened by the latest executive order signed by President Donald Trump. We'll have an update also on how East County cities are fighting back against a power grab at Sandag. And then on Sounds of History, we'll have an interview with the curator of the fascinating Guy B. Woodward Museum in Ramona. On Crime Beat, hear why an El Cajon tax preparer was sentenced to prison on fraud charges. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with some important news about health care reform efforts in California. The State Senate's Health Committee has approved by a 5-2 vote a bill that would provide free health care to all Californians, including medical, dental, vision, mental health, chiropractic, emergency, and nursing home care. The measure, Senate Bill 852, co-authored by San Diego Democratic Senator Tony Atkins, would establish a single-payer health care system similar to Medicare for All or the VA system that also aims to sharply reduce health care costs by cutting out insurance companies' profits. The key stumbling block is that the authors have not yet announced how they will pay for the costs of the bill. Critics contend that this could open the state up to incurring substantial debt. Calculating costs is challenging, however, since the federal government has not yet determined whether it will be fully repealing the Affordable Care Act and whether it will slash Medicare funding, as President Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress have threatened to do. Fears that Californians will be left without affordable health care options or even the ability to get insurance with pre-existing conditions if President Trump's proposals are adopted by Congress are fueling the drive in Sacramento for California to provide its own health care solutions to protect state residents. A key advantage if the measure passes, besides having healthier Californians, would be that the people of the state would no longer have huge medical expenses for premiums and care, and thus would have more disposable income. That would likely lead to increased spending on goods and services, starting new businesses, investments, and other expenditures that could boost the state's economy. The authors have commissioned a study on options for funding the ambitious measure. The bill is opposed, predictably, by insurance companies, as well as by the California Chamber of Commerce, which has labeled it a jobs killer. The industry that would be hardest hit in terms of job losses would be the insurance sector. The measure is supported, however, by the California Nurses Association, the California Teachers Association, numerous labor groups, and progressive organizations. The California Medical Association, which represents doctors, has yet to weigh in on either side on this important bill.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with a Green Scene Report. Sea levels rising much faster than expected could submerge over two-thirds of the state's beaches by the end of this century, also forcing damage and relocation of major infrastructure. Those are among the disturbing findings of an updated state commissioned report, Rising Seas in California. Sea levels could rise 30 to 40 times faster than in the last century, raising the sea level 10 feet after 2050 under the most severe scenario. The study looked at the most conservative and most extreme estimates. In the best-case scenario, a rise of 4 feet would cause loss of 384 feet of beach, or longer than a football field, over the next 70 years. Under the more extreme scenario, a 10-foot rise in ocean levels would cause land loss of 800 feet, the equivalent of an 80-story high-rise. That would have a huge adverse impact on California's $44 billion ocean-based economy, CalMatters reports. The report was produced by the California Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team in collaboration with the California Natural Resources Agency, the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, the California Energy Commission, and the California Ocean Science Trust. Two representatives of San Diego Strip's Institute of Oceanography were contributors to the report. A report by Zillow, the real estate site, recently predicted that more than 42,000 homes worth $49 billion in California could soon be underwater. Not with upside-down mortgages, but submerged beneath ocean levels that are rising 30 to 40 times faster than a century ago. California is already beginning to experience early impacts of rising seas, including more extensive coastal flooding during storms and increased erosion. But it is expected to get much worse due to melting of ice caps in Greenland and Antarctica. The latter disproportionately impacts California and the West Coast, where seas could rise 25% more than elsewhere. Heating up of ocean waters due to the release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is also contributing to rising sea levels. The state-led report is consistent with a federal report by the U.S. Geological Survey last month, which found that without a major intervention, up to 67% of California's beaches could be lost to rising seas by the end of this century. Locally, railways, roads, and bridges in San Diego County would need to be abandoned and relocated inland. As settlement talks continue on what to do with nuclear waste stored at San Onofre, the report warns ominously, power plants, nuclear waste sites, and other sensitive waterside sites need to be fortified or lost. In La Jolla, the odds of a 4-foot sea level rise are 33% by the year 2100, the end of the century, and 83% by the year 2200. Odds of even higher levels are also strong. A 6-foot rise by 2200 is likely 55%, and a 10-foot rise is a 14% possibility by 2200, the study authors predict. In Northern California, Delta flooding will overwhelm rivers and strain levees that are critical to our state's water supply, the report further warns. International airports in San Francisco and Oakland will also face flooding, becoming unusable. The study emphasizes that scientific understanding of sea level rise is advancing at a rapid pace, and public policy needs to catch up. The report concludes, consideration of high and even extreme sea levels in decisions with implications past 2050 is needed to safeguard the people and resources of coastal California.
This is Rebecca Williamson. Biologists at UC San Diego have demonstrated for the first time that a widely used pesticide can significantly impair the ability of honeybees to fly. The finding raises concerns about how pesticides affect bees' capacity to pollinate and the long-term effects on the health of honeybee colonies. Previous research has shown that foraging honeybees that ingested neonicotinoid and crop insecticides that are commonly used in agriculture were less likely to return to their home nest, leading to a decrease in foragers. A study published Wednesday in Scientific Reports by UCSD researchers along with a researcher from a university in Italy describes in detail how the neonicotinoid pesticide thiamethoxam damages honeybees. To test the hypothesis that the pesticide impairs flight ability, researchers designed and constructed a bee flight testing instrument. Months of testing revealed that the typical levels of neonicotinoid exposure, which bees could experience when foraging on agricultural crops, though below lethal levels, resulted in substantial damage to the honeybee's ability to fly. Researcher Simone Tassi says honeybee survival depends on its ability to fly because that's the only way they can collect food. Their flight ability is also crucial to guarantee crop and wild plant pollination. Long-term exposure to that pesticide over 1 to 2 days reduced the ability of bees to fly. James Nya, professor at UCSD's Division of Biological Sciences, observes, bees that fly more erratically for greater distances may decrease their probability of returning home. He adds, the honeybee is a highly social organism, so the behavior of thousands of bees are essential for the survival of the colony. We've shown that a sublethal dose may lead to a lethal effect on the entire colony. Honeybees carry out vital roles in nature, including global pollinization of crops and native plants. Declines in managed honeybee populations have raised concerns about future impacts on the environment, food security, and human welfare. Neonicotinoid insecticides are neurotoxic and used around the world on many crops, including common fruits and vegetables, through spray, soil, and seed applications. Evidence of these insecticides have been found in the nectar, pollen, and water that honeybees collect. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, has previously acknowledged that neonicotinoids have been responsible for some mass die-offs of bees and required warning labels, also limiting some applications when bees are present, but has stopped short of banning the pesticide. Professor Nya concludes, people are concerned about honeybees and their health being impaired because they are so closely tied to human diet and nutrition, adding, some of the most nutritious foods that we need to consume as humans are bee-pollinated.
Border Angels activist Hugo Castro is back in San Diego after more than $15,000 was raised online to pay for his medical evacuation from Mexico. His partner, Gaba Castro, posted the news on Facebook, but Castro may face a long recovery. KPBS reports that his injuries include multiple head wounds and possible brain damage. Castro was found severely beaten on a street in Tlalnepantla, Mexico, after posting a video on Facebook stating that his life had been threatened. At the time, he was on his way to help a relief caravan for refugees traveling from Central America to the U.S., an action aimed at protecting refugees from falling prey to human traffickers. His family has asked for continuing donations to help pay for his medical expenses. They have set up a GoFundMe webpage called Bring Hugo Home. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is Cindy Hanna with a public service announcement from CAL FIRE. Being ready for wildfires just got easier thanks to CAL FIRE's new Ready for Wildfire app. This new tool puts a whole library of step-by-step checklists in the palm of your hand. If you're a homeowner, you can track your progress while creating defensible space, hardening your home with fire-resistant construction, assembling an emergency supply kit, and creating a family communication and evacuation plan. With the tap of a finger on your cell phone, you can check off each step and see your progress until you reach 100% ready. The Ready for Wildfire app also provides critical wildfire alerts to protect your safety. You can sign up for customized alerts that will send a text or push notification to your device when a CAL FIRE is responding to a wildfire in your area. Additionally, you can set up alerts for single counties, multiple counties, or statewide. If you travel or enjoy hiking in forested areas, CAL FIRE has that covered too. The app lets you enable an alert system to notify you if a wildfire is reported within 30 miles of your cell phone or other electronic device. Everyone who downloads the Ready for Wildfire app before May 21st will also be entered into a drawing for a chance to win home hardening materials to protect your home from wildfires and flying embers that can travel up to a mile ahead of a fire. To download the Ready for Wildfire app, visit the App Store or the Google Play Store, search for CAL FIRE, and install. For more resources on getting ready for wildfire season, you can also visit readyforwildfire.org or readysandiego.org.
Two hikers were rescued over the weekend off Cowles Mountain. A 69-year-old woman suffered heat exhaustion and was airlifted off the trail on Saturday afternoon. Then, on Sunday, a second airlift was done to rescue a 25-year-old hiker who suffered an injury. She was taken by ambulance to a hospital for non-emergency treatment, according to San Diego Rescue Service. The Sheriff's Search and Rescue Service has also been kept busy this spring, making multiple rescues off trails in Cleveland National Forest, including in the Three Sisters Falls area. These incidents serve as reminders of the importance of following trail safety tips. Wear sturdy hiking shoes, carry an abundance of water, and be sure your cell phone is fully charged before you hit the trail. A permit is required for hiking in Cleveland National Forest, so you should register with the Forest Service before your outing. It's always wise to make sure someone knows where you are going when you head out for a hike and when you're expected back. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
State Route 67 between Ramona and Lakeside is one of the most accident-prone stretches of highway in San Diego County. Hoping to prevent head-on collisions, Caltrans is planning to install flexible posts between Willow Road in Lakeside and Shady Oaks in Ramona at a cost of $7.14 million. But at a March 30th meeting, Ramona Planning Group members pushed for a permanent concrete barrier between Cloudy Moon Drive and Mount Woodson that they believe will better protect public safety. Planning Group Chair Dan Scherer says planners don't believe the pop-up barriers, called channelizers, will be enough to prevent serious crashes. But so far, Caltrans has balked at the idea of a permanent concrete barrier due to issues that include limiting egress and visibility, costs to widen the road, and drainage concerns. Evacuation during a disaster could also be impacted, according to Caltrans. Another option being explored is a high-tension cable down the center median. Caltrans has long talked about widening Highway 67, but now claims it can't find the documents related to that proposal, the Ramona Sentinel reports. So, for now, these plans appear to have fallen by the wayside. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, I have two very special guests from the Heartland Coalition, Mark Hansen, the CEO President, and Terry Steele, the Marketing Consultant. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. Happy to be here.
And thank you so much for all of your wonderful work with East County Magazine over the last 8 years.
Well, you're welcome. Full disclosure, Heartland Coalition is the parent nonprofit of East County Magazine, but we're actually here today to talk about some other very exciting Heartland projects going on, specifically Heartland Youth Build, which I understand just got a great big grant from the federal government. Mark, can you tell us what that's about?
Sure. It's a grant for $1.1 million, And the grant focuses on generating tiny homes so they're affordable, and on getting students between 16 and 24, their high school diplomas, and also certificates in a wide number of construction trades. This year we're focusing on architecture and design, as well as rough and finish carpentry, and the students all get certified by the National Home Builders Institute and their pre-apprenticeship program.
That's fabulous. Affordable housing is such a critical problem in this area. There's just been some studies coming out. One of them found San Diego to be one of the least affordable housing markets in the nation right now. And of course, there's a lot of homelessness because of that. So it's a wonderful project that you're doing. Terry, can you tell us a little bit about Youth Build itself and what that's all about and what the mission is?
Certainly. Youth Build is a program, as Mark mentioned, funded by a $1.1 million Department of Labor grant. What we do is engage disaffected 16 to 24-year-olds, those from economically challenging areas who don't have a high school diploma and who don't have a job currently. What we do is then introduce them to the Youth Build program, help them get their diploma, give them two meals a day, public transportation to and from school, and commensurate with getting that diploma, we offer them field-based training in green building in construction, building those affordable homes so they can have a real sense of accomplishment and community, but also learn marketable skills upon graduation.
That's so important for the youth today. Now, how is Youth Build funded? Is it all from the federal government, or are there other sources as well?
There are other sources as well. Heartland Sustainable Housing has housing in other states. Chicago is a place where we have some homes. And when we can renovate and sell those, they can contribute to our overall Youth Build budget. We also receive donations and also smaller grants, a number of smaller local grants. And that's an ongoing basis. We're looking to banks for Community Reinvestment Act funding. And they get tax credits in doing that. We're negotiating with three banks right now, and they're going to talk to our students on Fridays about financial literacy and financial planning. So right. It's a symbiotic relationship.
Marvelous. And of course, Heartland is a 501c3 nonprofit, and so individuals can donate as well if they want to support this or any other Heartland project.
On our website, right.
Miriam, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because in addition to obviously what we need to fund the program itself, being able to introduce technology, perhaps computers, certainly materials when the kids are out there building those affordable homes and building special projects like some sustainable sheds that we're looking at introducing as a part of our micro-entrepreneurism program, all of that can come into play to really help make this program even more meaningful than it currently is.
So you're saying people can donate goods as well as services if maybe they have some spare computers sitting around they're not using, that sort of thing.
Yes, we've had 7 computers donated and one from East County Magazine. Thank you very much. We also have a program called Green Smart Sheds and Backyard Chicken Coops, kind of a long, funky name. But what we do with that, we design sheds for the city that are 10 by 8, and then for the country that are 12 by 12 tack rooms and things, and the students build them, and we do that in a very economical manner, and so they can look at their small business development, at least in developing the skills to run a small business, and that's a part of our training program as well, and they can get credit for that for their high school diploma too.
Fabulous. Those chicken coops sound like something that would be really popular out here in East County. There's a lot of people getting into raising their backyard flocks these days. Now, how do you determine who qualifies for a Youth Build education through the Youth Build Charter School?
They would respond to some media that we've done in churches and theaters, and Terry's prepared some wonderful articles. When they do that, they are invited to come in for an interview, and they're also invited to do that on the website. When they get on the website, heartlandyouthbuild.org, when they come in, they will fill out a long application, and we're sorry it's so long, and then come back usually another day to take something called a TABE test. It's a 2-hour test of adult basic education skills, and we'll focus the curriculum to make sure they learn those skills, to make sure they can do well on the SAT if they'd like to go to a 4-year school. And we have relationships with City College, Grossmont College, and San Diego State. So they have a full gamut of potential careers. Next year, we're adding advanced manufacturing, healthcare, financial services, and in 2 years, we would add a culinary arts program.
Very good. Sounds like a very varied bunch of programming. Terry, it looks like you've got something to say.
Well, yeah, I wanted to say one of the things that really attracted me to Mark's organization and the Youth Build program is that this program uplifts young people for whom traditional school just hasn't worked.
So people that have aged out or have dropped out or for some reason didn't get their high school diploma?
Yeah, or could be working to support their families. I mean, these folks are experiencing terrific hardship.
Yes.
And to be able to find someone who can... who cares about them, who can introduce them to marketable skills they can use in the real world, to provide them with immediate part-time jobs that allow them to earn while they learn.
Wonderful.
All of this really plays into the needs of those we're trying to help.
Yeah, that's such an important thing today with so many people who are low income, or maybe they're a refugee and they're helping to support their family, all these different things that we're seeing.
We have a full-time job developer, and he had 7 students' jobs just last Friday. Some were at Lowe's as food handlers. They went and did their training, and they all got jobs. So we placed students in part-time jobs that still allow them to get their diploma and their construction certificates.
Very good. Can you tell us a little more about the students at the school?
Yes. By and large, there are students who started high school but dropped out in the first couple of years for economic reasons. Some are from as far away as Chula Vista, some from El Cajon, and many students from El Cajon Middle School don't get to El Cajon High School because there's supportive efforts for their family. So their mother, who might not have a man in the house, is supporting younger brothers and sisters. So they go out and start a cleaning business, work very hard at jobs in fast food restaurants, but the jobs don't pay enough that it would allow them to progress in their life or get a car, go through school. The construction jobs will start at 16 an hour and rapidly go up to 24 an hour, and they could get through college that way even if they didn't have a scholarship.
Yes, exactly. Can you provide us some details about the curriculum at the Heartland Youth Build School?
Sure. We have a full curriculum, and the course requirements to graduate are 200 units like any other high school. They can get up 45 units of electives. There's some special things about our curriculum. One is we use the Khan Academy, and in the entrepreneurship program on the Khan Academy, we equate that to our small business development, but it has interviews with Elon Musk of Tesla and SpaceX. We have a lot of guest speakers. We have a strong emphasis on social and economic justice. The students are active in the community. They get credit for that. And they have all the traditional courses, 3 years of English, and they have math, science, and biology, all covered in small classes of no more than 15 students. And when they go out to the construction field, they might be in a one that has construction in the morning and academics in the afternoon, but then they switch. We have a bus, and the bus takes them back and forth to the construction sites, so they'll get in their full academic setting. The class goes from 8 to 3 after school, and 8 to 8:30 is a breakfast and a family meeting. But after school, they get additional tutoring if they're having problems with some specific problems on a subject. When they take our construction course, they have construction math, so they review fractions and decimals that they had in grade school, but people get rusty on them, and then we can convert those same lessons to algebra, and so we consider the pre-algebra. Fractions are a lot like algebra, but that's with X's and O's and not always with numbers. So we tie all that together.
Very good. It sounds like there's a lot of practical hands-on skills that they get in a very caring environment. Terry, did you have something to add to that?
Yeah, what I wanted to say is that it's indisputable that the core education you get in getting that high school diploma is certainly key. But with cuts in traditional industrial arts programs, it doesn't necessarily guarantee meaningful employment after graduation. Youth Build is filling that void by offering students the construction training that Mark referenced earlier. This is from the National Association of Home Builders, Home Builders Institute. And this year's inaugural session for 2017 will help our students qualify for a pre-apprentice certificate in carpentry. Some of the classroom instruction that we're going to be focusing on includes SketchUp 3D virtual building modeling, and that's applied to the actual youth build projects, be they the affordable homes that we're talking about building or those environmental sheds, our green smart sheds.
Right. So they will get a full curriculum, and they also get some career choices that have jobs in them right away. And we try to correlate the part-time jobs we get for them with their career interest. Each student has an individual learning plan, and it has seven areas of goals and plans of action for meeting those goals. So we do a great deal of goal setting and achievement.
And to complement all of that, we also have a broad brush construction-based curriculum. It's not just carpentry, but the basics in cross-cutting trades like electrical, plumbing, green building, and solar are obviously also addressed in the building of these affordable homes.
Great. So very cutting-edge skills to have in this growing green tech, clean tech economy we have here in San Diego County.
Literally and figuratively.
There you go. Now, the Youth Build Charter School itself is in a very central location, I understand, in City Heights. Can you give us details, please?
Yes, it's in the easternmost part of City Heights, so it's right in East County Magazine territory. It's about a mile and a half from San Diego State. It's across the street from Colinas del Sol Park, and there our students have swimming, they have free golf. We have a golf team we're developing to compete, hopefully, with Crawford and Hoover. We also have a softball team. And
very cool.
We have some good athletes. We have the student who was the CF wrestling champion last year. He's going to probably go to the Olympics. So he's not on our softball team because he continues to practice wrestling. They can get their PE credits if they don't have it. And we have a lot of outside activities. On Friday nights, we have barbecues and movies, and we go out and share with people in the community what we're doing with our program.
So if people wanted specifics on where to go, we're located at 5280 Orange Avenue, and that's in San Diego, as Mark had mentioned, with a zip of 92115, if you wanted to introduce that into your smartphone. We are open Monday through Friday from
8 to 5.
And we allow kids to come on by, check us out, and they can actually go through an initial screening right then and there.
We have counselors there who would do that.
And the website is heartlandyouthbuild.org, so people can go there and find information online.
Some people go to the other one, which is heartlandcln.org, and it has just very little on Youth Build. It covers seven other programs, so the best bet on this is go directly to the Youth Build site.
And then folks can also call 619-546-9259 or text Youth Build to 31996 to gain more information.
Okay, very good. So how are you promoting Youth Build and all of the wonderful things that you're doing there?
We have some special events and some special activities. One of them that is an event that Terry's worked very hard on, our car show. It's an event that will take place May 13th, and Terry, maybe you'd like to mention more about the car show.
Oh, please do. We have a lot of classic car lovers out here in East County who'd probably want to show up and learn more about this.
We sure do, Miriam. As a matter of fact, we're working with the San Diego Car Alliance and the 190 or so different car clubs that they have in their group to introduce a wide array of vehicles at what we're calling our inaugural Cool Car Classic. It'll be held at the Youth Build campus at 5280 Orange Avenue in San Diego, and we'll be introducing a $250 Best in Show car prize, cash prize, for the winning vehicle. We'll have a People's Choice competition. And what we want to do is really introduce a fun, family-oriented event that also piques the interest of the 16 to 24-year-olds we're interested in introducing to Youth Build, and certainly their friends, family, and advocates who may know someone who could benefit from the Youth Build program. 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, May 13th. And it's free to the public.
Free to the public, $25 to enter a car. We've noticed over our 18-year history in employment, people who have an interest in building cars also have an interest in building houses. We had a car company
for a while,
and everybody there in off-seasons would rehab houses, and then they'd rehab cars. So we're hoping to get some interest.
So you're tying it all together. Right. And unlike most car shows, the revenues from this one are helping to benefit the nonprofit programs that you've just been hearing about, the wonderful things that they're doing at Heartland's Youth Build to help students graduate, get their GED, and find good paying jobs right here in San Diego.
One thing that Mark is always saying that we all fully subscribe to is that now more than ever, it's really important for our youth to understand their available options in choosing and pursuing their academic and career goals. And we want these young people to know that a good education and high-wage careers are attainable no matter what their financial background.
Fabulous.
I wanted to mention also on the car show, Group San Diego, GROUPE, is our partner in this, and they come to all of our planning meetings, and they're just terrific people, and they've been a big assistance to us in planning this.
And Miriam, I've got to say, they've got some sweet lowriders. If you want to see some classic, exciting cars and talk to the people who know them inside and out, this is the place to be. Muscle cars, lowriders, Mustangs, just Corvettes, a Hellcat.
Lots of classics from the 50s and 60s, a whole Chevy collection, cars that go back to the 20s and 30s, and we'll probably have an electric car there too.
Very good. And if you are revved up listeners about this classic car show and you want to come out and take a look, once again, the website for that is
www.heartlandyouthbuild.org.
And keep in mind, too, this event is right behind Faith Lutheran Church. The school's located in a Lutheran school that was built years ago. And sometimes people don't see it behind the large church.
Yes, so it's a non-religious school, of course, but it's located on a church property.
There. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you'll be seeing those 70 cars lined up, and you won't want to take your eyes off them. So we welcome one and all. It'll be a great day of fun and enlightenment as well.
You bet.
Very good. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Mark Hansen and Terry Steele from Heartland Youth Build in San Diego. You can find out more about them at heartlandyouthbuild.org. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much, Miriam.
Thank you, Miriam. Always a pleasure. Really enjoy the magazine as well.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
10 of California's national monuments could be reduced in size or even eliminated as part of a review of all such properties in an executive order signed by President Donald Trump. The order reportedly instructs U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to examine all monuments designated since 1996 during the past three administrations. Daniel Segura with the Mojave Desert Land Trust worries that Southern California's Mojave Trails, Santa Snow, and Castle Mountain National Monuments, all created in February 2016, could be threatened.
And here at the Mojave Desert Land Trust, we fought hard to protect these desert lands, and we're prepared to fight against any latest attacks on them. These are public lands, and they benefit our local community.
Other California public lands that could be at risk include parts of Sequoia National Forest, the California Coastal National Monument, and parks at Carrizo Plain, Fort Ord, San Gabriel Mountains, and Berryessa Snow, as well as a Central Valley National Monument honoring farmworkers' rights activist Cesar Chavez. President Obama set aside more land than any other chief executive, a move that led some conservative lawmakers to claim executive overreach. It's unclear whether the Trump administration will try to shrink the boundaries of certain parks or revoke some designations altogether, but Segura says any such moves would be unpopular.
I think the American people value deeply their public lands. I mean, it's really such a part of who we are as people and our spirit. And I think that this executive order, this initial inquiry, is against who we are as a country.
A bill now before the U.S. Senate would require that all future national monuments be approved by the governor and legislature of the state in which the park is located. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Assembly Bill 805 passed the Assembly Local Government Committee by a 5-4 vote. The measure claims to reform Sandag, but in fact gives virtually all power to the cities of San Diego and Chula Vista, leaving East County cities and other communities in our county powerless to add agenda items to benefit other cities or block objectionable measures at Sandag, the Metropolitan Transit System, and North County Transit District. Now, East County cities are fighting back. On Tuesday, La Mesa's City Council will consider a proposal from Council Members Bill Baber and Christine Alicio to hire a legislative lobbyist to advocate on La Mesa's behalf against AB 805, which was authored by San Diego Assembly Member Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher. El Cajon City Council has voted to oppose AB 805, as did Lemon Grove and La Mesa. East County Assemblyman Randy Vopel, former Mayor of Santee, voted against the measure in committee. Gonzalez Fletcher, who represents San Diego and Chula Vista, says the measure is needed because Sandag was caught misinforming the public on cost of a recent failed transportation ballot initiative. But her bill goes much farther than requiring an independent audit and investigation. It shifts the balance of power to give a majority vote to San Diego and Chula Vista, which she justifies based on their larger population size. Lemon Grove Councilman Jerry Jones has sent a letter opposing AB 805 to the Assembly Transportation Committee, where it will next be heard. Jones writes, "Allowing San Diego to make decisions unilaterally with a weighted vote only at Sandag would be the end of the regional collaboration and decision-making. There would simply be no incentive for them to work collaboratively with the other jurisdictions in the region or to embrace the consensus we've come to know in the region." He also objects to the bill granting chairmanship to San Diego and Chula Vista on a rotating basis, shutting out other cities in the county from a leadership role on Sandag. Jones argues that Sandag is not broken, as Gonzalez Fletcher contends, noting that regional collaboration has in fact produced two successful measures in the past, Transnet and Transnet 2, both approved by voters. AB 805 has been amended to remove one objection raised by small cities in the region. Originally, it required that only mayors could serve on the Sandag board, but that was deleted after objections from cities with part-time mayors who work day jobs that would make it hard to attend a Sandag meeting. But Jones says the measure is really a power grab that seeks to take power away from everyone and every jurisdiction outside of those represented by Gonzalez Fletcher. Councilman Jones told East County Magazine, "I will argue that my minority and low-income citizens have just as much right to be fairly represented as San Diego and Chula Vista. While accountability and transparency elements of the bill have merit," he concludes, "good decisions and change are made from proper examination of facts and not political vendettas." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, from the mountains to the sea.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, guest hosting the Sounds of History, recording on the road today in Ramona. We are at the Guy B. Woodward Museum in Ramona, which is a marvelous place, and it is my great pleasure today to introduce our special guest, Ken Woodward, who is the curator of the museum. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, I understand that your own family has long roots in Ramona. Tell us a little bit about your own family history first, and then we'll talk about the museum.
Yes, my family came out of Kellogg, Iowa. They came to Ramona in 1896, and the whole family, aunts, uncles, grandfather, grandmother, kids, girlfriends, the whole group. Two of them, they were actually farmers and dairymen out of Kellogg, Iowa.
And so what brought them to California, and how did they get here?
Well, they had lived in Iowa for many, many years, and they were just simply getting tired of the harsh winters and trying to take care of their farms and cattle. And so the whole family just packed up and came westward. That was my great-grandfather and all of his brothers and sisters.
Now, I understand that your family has quite the history here in Ramona. Can you give us a couple of highlights?
Yes. My family, they were farmers and dairymen, and later, my dad and his six brothers and sisters became very attached to Ramona. They grew up here. My dad's brother became a very famous historical archaeologist. and historian. And my dad moved on in the 1930s and became chief of police in Oceanside, where he finished his years.
Now, let's hear about the museum.
The primary purpose of the museum was to commemorate the old-timers in Ramona, and they came here, they began coming here in about 1870.
Now, can I understand that when your father was putting this whole marvelous museum together with all these different buildings, that he got some help from somebody who had a lot of experience in stage set design? Tell us about that.
Yes, he was very fortunate. Mr. Bill Cowan had moved to Ramona, and he had retired, and Bill Cowan was actually worked for Walt Disney Studios, and he built sets and built towns for Walt Disney Studios. So when my dad got ready to begin building some of the old barns and everything, he was very glad to help.
Yeah, this really does look like you've been plopped down and reincarnated in the middle of the Old West here with all these wonderful buildings. The centerpiece of it is the Theophile Verlaki House.
Yes.
And that was built, I understand, in 1886?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the house and how it came to be built.
Yes, Theophile Verlaki, he was a Basque from southern France. And at the time, he left France in 1870 to come to the New World to make his living. The whole Verlaki family came in to New Orleans, and then he found his way in 1870 to San Diego. And he became very prominent in San Diego. He built several businesses there, became one of the largest wine producers in San Diego.
Wow, so Ramona's wine industry has roots that go all the way back to the 1800s. Very interesting. And today it's certainly a thriving business up here. What can people see if they go into the Verlaki house today?
Well, I always tell people that they need to understand that everything they see here on this property has all been donated, mainly because the museum is a nonprofit organization. And when they go into that beautiful home, and it is all adobe, and they will find it beautifully furnished with all donated furniture, with all kinds of books in the library, with all kinds of furnishings in throughout.
And there's also a doctor's office. Tell us about that.
And there's a really interesting doctor's office. One of the bedrooms has been converted into a doctor's office. And that is, we have very old medical equipment that actually goes back to the 1800s that doctors have been donating to the museum. And it's really fascinating to see these old pieces of equipment.
There's also some very ornate furnishings. There's a fabulous antique grand piano in there, an old pump organ, a Victrola, and in one of the back bedrooms, I understand there's a bedroom set with an interesting history too, very ornate.
Yes, the bedroom set is brought in to the museum in 1980, and this lady came in and said, I'd like to donate this beautiful bedroom set. It was built in 1840 back in Connecticut, but she said, you need to know who I am. She said, first of all, I'm part of the Yale family, the producers of the Yale Lock Company, and my great-great-grandfather in 1840 was the person who put together the Yale Lock Company.
Now, there's a lot more than just a vintage home on this property, however. You have amassed an amazing collection of some of the original buildings here in Ramona. Folks, if you come out here to the museum, the Guy B. Woodward Museum, you can see a vintage schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, a barn, buggies, all kinds of interesting buildings, covered wagon, and also a jail. Now, I understand there's a really colorful history behind that jail. Tell us about it.
The jail was actually built in San Diego about 1890, and the jail was brought up here, 7 tons of iron brought up to Ramona, and installed as the Ramona Jail. And then it, in the 1930s, it disappeared. And
so the jail was stolen?
No. The county of San Diego started using it for a dynamite storage, and it was found in a canyon and brought back to the museum.
Now, I understand that your mother used to have a job related to the jail.
Actually, that was my grandmother. And my grandmother, back in the early late 1800s, her job was to feed the prisoners, and she got 15 cents a day to bring them broth in.
And it has now been restored and brought back here to Ramona, and you can see it if you come out to visit the Guy B. Woodward Museum. Now, there's some other interesting buildings here. We're doing the interview actually sitting here in an old barn. What's the history of this?
Actually, it was one of my dad's ideas to bring in all of the old barns and all the old buildings that he could to the museum property. This barn was built in 1870. It was built by the Barnett family who came into Ramona from San Francisco area.
Looks like it's set up for meetings. Do you hold different kinds of meetings or events in here nowadays?
Yes. Every other month we have a potluck, and people are simply invited to bring something that they can share with everyone else. And we come in here and we have speakers on history and Ramona and things of this nature. It's really very good.
What fun. That's just an amazing resource to find. This place is a veritable treasure trove. As you walk through, you see antique dolls and vintage clothing and furnishings and tools. And there was a very interesting giant cook pot out there. Tell us about that.
The cook pot actually belonged to the Ortega family. And the Ortega family came to the valley in 1843. And they actually owned all 17,000 acres here in the valley.
So this was the family that received the land through the original Spanish land grant.
That's correct. And so the Ortegas proceeded to use the valley for farming all kinds of wheat and everything.
Now, of course, long before the original settlers came here, we had the Native Americans, the Kumeyaay people. I understand you have some Native American artifacts that people can see here as well.
Yes, the Kumeyaay Indians came to the valley 2,000 years ago, and we have some beautiful Indian artifacts, a whole display in the basement from that tribe.
Wow, I would love to take a look at that. And I understand, by the way, that the Kumeyaay now say they trace their history in the San Diego region back 10 to 12,000 years. Interesting, they've recently found some artifacts in some other areas that suggest they may have been here even a lot longer than that. There are also a lot of interesting vehicles here. I see some vintage buggies, you know, like horse-drawn buggies, and what looks like a Conestoga wagon or covered wagon out there. What can you tell us about those?
Yes, the one large wagon that we have, it seats about 12 people, and it used to take all the people that came into Lakeside into Julian. It took 12 hours for that wagon to take 12 people from Lakeside to Julian.
My goodness, how times have changed, and the kids think they have it rough now. Now, when your father was first getting started and putting this all together, there was another benefactor from San Diego who came along. He was the owner of San Diego Trust and Savings. Can you give us some details?
Yes, Mr. Thomas W. Sefton stopped by to see my dad one time and introduced himself, and my dad took him all the way through the museum and told him what he intended to do, and Mr. Sefton said, "Guy, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to donate my mining equipment to the museum," which he did later on.
Yeah, and your father started this back in the 1980s or so, and then I understand that after he passed on and after Mr. Sefton passed on, the mantle kind of fell to you, and you came along and went downtown to retrieve all the mining equipment.
Yes, we were very fortunate because the Sefton family gave me a call one day, and they said, "Ken, I understand that our father promised to give you all of the mining equipment from the Colorado, California, Nevada gold mines." And I said, "Yes, he did." And they said, "Well, come down and get it."
What else did you find when you went down there?
First of all, they directed me to a warehouse next on Marina Boulevard, right next to the train tracks. And so I went down, knocked on the door, took a look, and the train tracks actually came into this large barn area, and Mr. Sefton's own personal railroad car was there.
What those very wealthy travelers used to use to go cross-country in the olden days. Now, he also donated some other interesting things. I see a tall ship replica down here. What else?
Well, in addition to the ship replica, it's difficult to believe, but he also donated the keys to Mount Vernon, George Washington's house. And that has always been a very interesting display.
Well, there you go. That's amazing. What else could people see that you would like people to know about the museum and the facilities here?
Well, the way the museum is put together, I think, is the most important, because all of a sudden the centerpiece is the Verlac House, built in 1886. You have a full-size basement, which is filled with beautiful artifacts. Then we have adorned on, my dad had brought in all of these buildings from the 1870s, and he reconstructed them here on the property. We're sitting in an old barn that was built in 1870.
It's amazing. It's really one of those little-known treasures we have out here in East County that I think a lot of people don't know about and would love to visit if they could. Now, speaking of visiting, when is the museum open to the public?
The museum is open to the public as advertised Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 1 to 4 o'clock. However, the museum is also open Monday through Thursday. We have one of our workers here, and they will open up the museum to anyone that desires to come in during the week.
Well, that's a good tip for our listeners here at East County Magazine. I know it's run by a nonprofit organization. So if people have maybe old artifacts out there from the Ramona area in their basements or attics, who would they get in touch with if they have something they may wish to donate?
They would get in touch with our main office here on the grounds and describe what they would like to donate to see if we can use it and see if it fits in. And that has been done. You'll be surprised at the number of artifacts that we have here that are local to Ramona.
Wonderful. So if you want to visit the museum, you can visit their website at www.woodwardmuseum.org. Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the Woodward Museum or the history of Ramona?
Well, I think it's really interesting. We have people from all over the world going through this museum. People coming in to visit California, they hear about the museum, they come up and they get a wonderful trip through the museum.
And it's located right on Main Street here in the heart of downtown Ramona today. Ken, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you very much, and it's been a delight talking to you.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Getz with a Crime Beat Report. In a month when most Americans just paid their income taxes, the owner of Cunningham's Tax Service in El Cajon has been sentenced to 3 years in federal prison for preparing phony tax returns. Marla Lynn Cunningham was charged with 36 counts and pled guilty to 3 of those. According to the Justice Department, she filed returns for her clients that reported fake business losses such as phony charitable contributions, as well as bogus expenses such as medical, education, and employee costs. Her actions cheated taxpayers out of more than $1.2 million in taxes that should have been paid by her clients, NBC7 reports. The Justice Department announced Cunningham will also pay nearly $92,000 in restitution to the IRS, or less than 10% of the sum she bilked the government out of. The government has not announced whether it may also go after her clients to repay money from the scam. Her sentence includes a year of supervised release after she serves her 37-month sentence in prison.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.